Oh, hi, and welcome to another episode of the Westmarch Workshop. I want to start this one off with a little bit of an apology. I'm sorry. I was right after the recording the last episode. I went on vacation, and that vacation was a little bit busier than I expected. So I was a little bit delayed in going through and getting episode 205 uploaded. So it was late. It was really late, and that's my bad. That's my fault. Sorry about that. Sorry. But here we are with episode 206, What in the World Stone? And in tonight's episode, I'll be going through and covering a couple of topics. We've got some updates on Diablo 3 with patch 2.7 and the season 23 start date, as well as some controversial changes that happened between the PTR and the patch notes. With some of the sets and such, you know, some things that might be getting addressed. We've got some interesting tweets that I mentioned in passing from one of the former Blizzard North developers that have been going through and being a really cool trip down memory lane into seeing some of the development of Diablo 2. We'll also be going through and talking about the Reaper of Souls anniversary that is nigh upon us, which of course means the anniversary of the Westmarch Workshop. And I'll be closing out the episode with a little bit of lore about the Worldstone. So sit back, relax, and, well, let's jump into it. So again, sorry about the late upload on that last episode. This one, I hope I'll be able to go through and get up in a more timely manner. But as my phone continues to explode from work tonight, we will see about that. But yeah, so since the last episode, I kind of touched a little bit, you know, kind of like skipped through the patch notes that we have for patch 2.7 and season 23. But in order to go through and do a bit of a deeper dive, you know, into what we can expect, we've got, let's see, let me pull this up here. We've got some finalized patch notes that have been not well received by the community. You know, mostly it comes down to the Firebird's Finery, one of the most changed sets in the game. And it came out swinging at the beginning of the PTR and was subsequently toned down. But then what people weren't expecting is that after it had already been toned down into more of a power level that was appropriate compared to other classes, but was still, you know, probably the best wizard set at the time, was toned down even further in this patch. And so a lot of people were, you know, pretty upset about that. Wizards have been having some issues for a while. It has been quite some time since the wizard was at the top of the meta. You know, they went through and nerfed the bazooka build. They've been struggling a little bit in group play, and wizards themselves have also, of course, you know, kind of been struggling in the solo region. But you know, with the original advent of the PTR, the most recent change to the Firebird's Finery set was amazing, and people were going through and just absolutely blasting it at the high end, and they were expecting that it was going to go through and get toned down, and it did during the PTR. It was something that was a little bit, you know, it was still like way up there. So when we went through and we got the actual patch notes, which dropped it down even further, people weren't expecting that. And so, you know, a lot of wizards were pretty upset about that. They were expecting, oh, we've got a new build that we can try out, you know, for the top end play. Is going to go through and change up, you know, solo and all those other types of stuff. And then those dreams were dashed as it like the proposed changes tanked it by a good number of greater rift levels. You know, like 10 plus greater rift levels it would have dropped, putting it down into kind of like mid-range of the pack of wizard builds. But the developers are listening, and so one of the things that they went through and mentioned Filthy Rich went and took to the forums and said that they have been listening to the feedback regarding the Firebird's finery set, and that they're investigating opportunities to update some of the changes, nerfs, that were recently posted in the preview blog. We're hoping to get this working soon, and we'll update the thread and blog along with any developer notes that we can to keep you all in the loop. Appreciate the patience, and we'll have more to share soon. This is awesome that they're at least going through and listening to the feedback in order to go through and make that build better. I think that's one of the biggest things that people are just looking for. You've got a new patch that it doesn't have a seasonal theme, but they're changing up things with the followers and the emanate system, as well as, you know, adding in some, you know, new cool things for the leaderboards with the different sets that are giving players a lot of new tools to play around with their characters, but you know, maybe not too many new builds in order to go through and try, especially if you're going to try to push the absolute highest end on, like, the combined leaderboards. It's one thing if you're happy just, say, you know, pushing, you know, the Firebird set with the new Firebird specific, you know, wizard leaderboard, but it's different if you want to push the overall wizard leaderboard in order to go through and hit up there. And I think that's what some people were just, you know, concerned about. They thought that they had a new toy in order to go through and push their wizards to a whole new level, but it wasn't there. It looks like they're going to potentially maybe either revert one of the nerfs or scale back one of the nerfs between the PTR in the actual patch. And they said that they're working on the timing of it. So I imagine it's probably going to be something that either is going to, they'll have it done in time. And so when the patch comes out on Tuesday, March 30th, that they'll have a revised patch notes to share at that point with the new change. Or I would think sometime pretty soon after that, because one of the other things that took people a little bit off guard was we don't have the 2-week turnaround time between seasons. One of the things that had been a standard for the seasons for quite some time now has been that there would be 2 weeks in between the end of a season and the start of the next one. You would always have the season end, you know, on a Sunday evening, and then start on a Friday evening 2 weeks afterwards. So, you know, you wouldn't have the full 2 weeks, but close enough. But now, with just that 1 week period, you've only got 5 days, since the season itself will be ending on March 28th, and then the new season is starting on April 2nd. That's a really quick turnaround time that we haven't, you know, had to deal with for, you know, over, for, I mean, that's been quite a few seasons. It's been over a year or two now, you know, that we've had that 2 week grace period in between seasons. And so, you know, those people, especially those that are going through and pushing, you know, to try and get their record clears, you know, for the end of the season, spending thousands and thousands of keys, you know, fishing for that perfect rift, now don't really have much of a breather, because you're pushing up to Sunday evening, you're going to work, you know, whether that be, you know, your 9-to-5 desk job, or you're a full-time streamer. And so you're still not even being able to really relax all that much playing, like, variety games or anything. You're just right back at it, because a lot of the big streamers are going through and they're practicing their pushes on, you know, Wednesday, Thursday, in order to make sure that they've got that perfect, you know, group start in order to get to 70, you know, within an hour, in order to then just start, you know, blasting, getting the season done and all of that. So, I'm not sure, you know, they haven't specifically said whether they're going to be, you know, that this is the new norm. They've just not addressed it, you know, are we going to go back to the 1 week grace period in between the seasons? Are they cutting down the 2 week period because, you know, season 22 just lasted so long, and so they want to give the players something new to go through and play with and test out? Don't know, but I'm hoping that Blizzard will go through and address it, you know, at some point, with the hopes that this is just like a one-off or an oddity of some sort, just because of the length of the season, that they wanted to get back into it quickly, and that it's not a sign of a new status quo or things to come. I think most people were happy with the 2 weeks in between the seasons and would like to see that return with the rollover between season 23 and season 24. Many months from now, of course. Other than that, you know, the Rathmas, they brought Rathmas up like a little bit, comparatively, from what it was nerfed on the second round of PTR testing, so that way it has a little bit more cooldown reduction, but at the same time, it now only the permanent pets, so like the skeletons, the golem, and the revives are counted, when you have the item that buffs them up to be permanent. To give the cooldown reduction for Army of the Dead, but they doubled the actual reduction itself. So that way, like, mages don't really have much of an effect. So I think the overall net is about a wash. And they also raised the cap on the 6-piece damage up to 9,000%, which I think the only way of actually doing that is skeletons, max revives, and a golem in order to go through and get that. But then they also nerfed the Bonds of Selena in order to go and tone down some of that damage. So they completely removed the bone spear or the bone spirit bonus damage, and they gutted the Army of the Dead damage on it. So much akin to like Firebird's Finery, necromancers were having this new cool tool that they could go through and play around with at the higher solo play. It wasn't really going to make much of a difference in like the group metas or anything like that, but it kind of got its legs cut out from underneath it when people were expecting to have something really cool to go through and try out. And now you have something that, while is still cool and you have your individual set leaderboard to try it out, it's not really going to be changing up things if you're going to be pushing or if you want to be doing like some higher end stuff. It could potentially make its way into like some speed clears and such, but it might be overshadowed by just your regular Singularity Mage. In terms of just overall speed for your XP farming, solo XP farming, the Singularity Mage, of course, is still going to be the go-to for rat runs. They slightly brought off some of the nerfs from the Gears of the Dreadlands, but that set is still going to be pretty powerful. This power level is more in line, and of course, they didn't touch anything with the Gaze of Demise, so it's scaling. 150% bonus that it would get for each one of the phantasms that were up is now just a flat 150 damage. And so the Mundanugus, for like the 10th straight patch, I believe almost every single patch since Mundanugus was added into the game, they've nerfed the set or one of the supporting pieces. And I think they finally have hit home, because this one is going to be dropping it down to the point where you're no longer going to be hitting your, Greater Rift 150, a couple weeks into the season. This is going to be for your late game pushes to try and get that high, if it can actually punch at that weight class any further. Witch Doctors got neutered. Firebirds and Rathmas got gutted. Firebirds might see some buffs before the patch or when the patch itself goes live. We'll see how that plays out because we don't have the numbers. And nothing was really mentioned for Rathmas. So maybe it might have to wait a patch or two for Rathmas. But I expect that after 2.7, once we get to like 2.8, we might see some more radical changes for set and item balancing. Just because... they didn't say specifically that one of the reasons for season 22 and patch 2.6 lasting for so much longer than what was expected, they haven't given an official reason for it, but I would have to assume like those follower and emanate changes as well as the leaderboard changes, that's some big stuff for background updates. And that's what I'm thinking is why it took so long, and that was eating up the vast majority of the development time. So as long as they don't have any massive overhauls of that nature for the next patch, we'll probably see a bit more class and set balancing to bring a little bit more parity to those classes in those sets, because things have languished a little bit as they've added new things and tweaked, you know, those new things. You know, a lot of those old sets have fallen to the wayside. It would be cool to see, you know, another, you know, rebalancing to bring things a bit more in line with one another. Well, at the same time, it is at least nice that they are taking some steps in order to make it so that the balance point isn't GR150, that every single class and set should be able to clear GR150 solo without any issues. That they're making that a little bit more unobtainable, and that the 150 marks is more for group play than anything else, or, you know, cheesing seasonal mechanics or something along those lines. But it is good to see that they are going and taking into account that maybe some things deserve to be nerfed. That pretty much will be the long and the short of the patch changes. But you know, while we're still on the topic of Diablo 3, this show is recording on Wednesday, March 24th, and I would like to give a special shout out to the Reaper of Souls anniversary, which is tomorrow, March 25th. And going and thinking back, that it's been 7 years that we've been on Reaper of Souls, back in 2014, and that 7 years ago, I was in LA at a launch party, you know, for Reaper of Souls, and that was like one of those things that, you know, was a big moment in my life. You know, Leviathan and I have talked about it so often on the show. It shouldn't be a surprise to anybody, but it's such a cool trip down memory lane, going and, you know, checking out the photos and such, to just get some, you know, thoughts and feelings on, you know, where I was, you know, 7 years ago, and that impact that it's had on my life, you know, since that date. Because this was one of those ones where the podcast itself was still up in the air, but it was at the launch party and just feeding off of the passion from the developers that Archon and I were like, yeah, we're doing this. You know, we're absolutely doing this. You know, it was like the first time, you know, like meeting a lot of people, you know, like, Tivalier, you know, the old CM who was Water Fiend on DiabloII.net, you know, Leviathan, going through and meeting him in person, you know, for the first time, you know, Archon, a whole bunch of other people. It was like a night of memories. It was just this really cool, awesome thing to do. But also, the season opener for season 23 will be on April 2nd. Which is the 7th anniversary of the West March Workshop. So I Longshot can hold me to this one. I already know he's going to be typing in chat. I will plan on streaming the season opener as I normally do on April 2nd. And it will be a small little, you know, party and such, because it will also be the 7-year anniversary, you know, for the West March Workshop. It won't be here on the BlizzPro channel. It'll be on mine, so you'd want to go through and check me out over at, you know, twitch.tv/9ball for that little stream. But it will be cool. You know, there's also the level with the cause that's going to be going on for every season opener and such. And, you know, I'll be playing around with the Necromancer as I do, and testing out the Rathma set, since I didn't really get a chance to test it out on the PTR. So definitely go through, keep your eye on that. It would be a cool, fun little stream, and I'm looking forward to it. Really am. We also, on the topic of Diablo stuff, one thing that I was not expecting to see is that some websites like Wowhead and such have noticed that on the Blizzard content networks, some strings for internal testing for Diablo 2 Resurrected have popped up. So there is some potentiality at a upcoming alpha test for D2 Resurrected, which again isn't too big of a surprise. They said it's coming out 2021, and we're already a third of the way through the year. You know, well, I guess we'll be a third of the way through the year next week. Let's get rolling. Let's go. We got to get this testing. I will definitely be looking forward to that. In addition to, you know, Immortal. We gonna get any news about Immortal? Looking forward to that one too. It's such a great year for being a Diablo fan. We're getting D2 Resurrected, we're getting Diablo Immortal. We've got like whole new life being breathed into Diablo 3. It's great. This is some really, really good times. And while we're talking about Diablo 2, one of the things that I've been going through, and I kind of mentioned a little bit in last week's episode, was we've been having a trip down memory lane on Twitter. And so I want to give like a little special shout out to Phil Schenk, which the name might be familiar because he of course has, you know, Schenk the Overseer named after him in Act 5 of Diablo 2. That he was one of the lead artist over at Blizzard North for developing Diablo 2 as well as Lord of Destruction. And he helped build up the lore and the story for the Diablo 2. And he's been going through and every day or every couple of days, he's been sharing behind-the-scenes stories of the development and such. A lot of it, you know, it's kind of like going in a timeline. So it's starting, like, his first starting with the company and such. And so going through and developing some of the things that he created. Most recently, he's been going and talking about, like, the Corrupted Rogues from Act 1. The story behind Blood Raven and all other types of stuff. And he shared, like, the first piece of lore that he ever wrote, which was, like, the story behind Blood Raven. And I will say, please go check him out on Twitter. It's P-Schenk, P-S-H-E-N-K, in order to go through and get the full one. But I just wanted to read a little tidbit from the story that he went through and posted, because I felt that it was pretty awesome. Let's see. So the story basically goes through and takes place where Blood Raven was one of the rogues. In the context of this story, Blood Raven was one of the rogues that the Sisters of the Sightless Eye had sent to Tristram to try and find out the cause of the evil that had been plaguing the land that would eventually go on to help defeat Diablo. But it hadn't been kind of like solidified yet. And I think that the story that eventually happened was it was just like Blood Raven was the only rogue that went and survived. And so not all of this is what actually fully made it into the game, so it's not like fully canon, but just an idea of even back before Diablo 2 launched in 2000, that there was like some topics that were being created, some topics and some kind of like, groundwork being laid for the franchise. And so I'm just going to read this passage and let me know if it strikes a bell with anybody. The new assembly quickly developed revolutionary techniques to improve their skills in combat. They learned to delve further into their spiritual center to harness powerful energies that could be focused into physical speed and power. They formulated elixirs and potions to heighten their perceptions and strengthen their bodies. They discovered arcane rituals that could be used to protect them in battle and summon terrible spirits to their aid. There were some in the Order who were concerned with these advances. They were fearful that the assembly was moving too fast and that such powerful things might not be able to be fully controlled. They asked Blood Raven to slow down the pace of the endeavor so that they might more fully comprehend the things that they were bringing upon themselves. Blood Raven was a proud and powerful woman, and she was excited and tantalized by the things that she had glimpsed, but her respect for the elders of the Order held greater sway, and she agreed to their warnings. And so it's just like one of those things that even then it's going through and it has those little teasers, those little tidbits of that inner Nephilim strength. And, you know, I'm really excited to see as Phil continues to go down these stories, because he's going and sharing the art first, because he didn't really get apparently into as he's going through and saying on Twitter, he didn't get into the lore building until more into like Lord of Destruction and such. And now, the Lord of Destruction was like the first time that term Nephilim got dropped. And so I I can't wait to go through and see, you know, where that maybe he'll be able to tell us where the concept of the Nephilim and such actually came from, because it was just like a throwaway term in Diablo 2. It wasn't with the context that it had now. That didn't come about until a few years after Diablo 2 come out, Lord of Destruction had come out. I think it was in 2006. Let me look that up. The Sin War trilogy. I should have had this up on screen, but the Sin War trilogy was first published. Birthright was published in 2006, October 1st, 2006. Yes. All right. This was 5 years after the release of Lord of Destruction before we actually got more of a codified meaning of what it was to be a Nephilim. So to even see some of these terms all the way back then, in the 90s still, before Diablo 2 had even come out, not so much terms, but you're beginning to see, you know, that groundwork, that foundation laid of some of these concepts that would become core components to the Diablo franchise. And so it's definitely worth going through checking out. Again, go follow this man on Twitter, PShank, over on Twitter, in order to go through. I'm going and retweeting it every time he goes through and he posts one of these, like, discussions. Obviously, he is still, you know, a very busy person, so he's got his day job and such, so he doesn't post them every day. You know, there's sometimes his gaps in between, but they are worth it. So please, definitely do yourself a favor if you are interested in Diablo history, kind of the lore of the video game Diablo, not the lore within the video game Diablo, but the lore and history of how these things came to be as the title itself in the franchise. Check it out. It's cool. The history is awesome. While we're talking about lore and history, I wanted to again go through and talk about some things that I find cool and I find intriguing, and that is, of course, lore and story. And with this week's episode, I wanted to go and talk a little bit about the World Stone, which is something that is a story that's still in progress. Here we are, 20 years after the destruction of the World Stone and Lord of Destruction, and our first glimpse of what the World Stone even was, and we still aren't quite sure what the World Stone was. Yeah, we know that it's a leftover artifact and it's a piece of the creator deity Anu, because when Anu shed all of those evil emotions from his being to create the seven-headed dragon Tathamet, and they fought to the death, it's literally called the Eye of Anu, and it is very well possible that the World Stone is literally his eye, or a fragment thereof, and it contains, you know, some of this power of the original entity that created the universe and everything within it. And so this aptly named World Stone was used by the forces of heaven and hell to go and create worlds, whole worlds and systems that would either quickly decay and rot, from just the chaotic nature of the demons, or would just be too stringent and orderly to support life at all by the angels. But it had just this vast power and was the entire center of the conflict between the angels and the demons, and of course what we know as the eternal conflict or the great conflict. And as they warred and fought, for countless eons, since almost quite literally the beginning of time, we had the group of angels and demons that were led by Inaris and Lilith to concoct a plan to steal the World Stone and create a peaceful escape that they could go to in order to free themselves, from this eternal conflict. They were tired of the warring, and so they created their own personal sanctuary. And this was the first time that the World Stone had ever been used by the combined forces of heaven and hell, going back to the original being Anu, who at the beginning had encompassed all things, not just the pure good and orderly aspects that he had taken on when he fought Tathamet, but when Tathamet was still a part of his being and encompassed everything. And so Sanctuary, this literal perfect world, you know, was the home to the first angels and demons, and when they intermingled, they bore the Nephilim that had this spark of this, the original creator deity in them. And so they were much greater than the sum of their parts. They held power that astonished the angels and the demons, and, caused them to be fearful. Lilith saw an opportunity that she could raise an army to go through and defeat the forces of heaven and hell in the eternal conflict and rule over all creation with her at the top and, Anarius, her husband, at the side. And Anarius saw abominations and at first thought that he should kill them all, but then it's like, oh, they're my children. I don't really understand the concept of children, but, I created these things because angels don't have kids. He went into self-exile while Lilith went around and killed everybody. She saw all the angels and demons. Some of them wanted to kill the Nephilim, and she didn't want to see her children, her weapon, her tool that she could use to rule creation, harmed, and so she killed them. And then she saw others that were like-minded of her and saw them as a tool that could be used for great power. She saw them as a rival, and so she killed them too. And by the time that Anarius got back around with his soul-searching, found Sanctuary, routed of all angels and demons, all of the fellow renegades that they had plotted to escape the eternal conflict, slaughtered by Lilith and her with a standing army of Nephilim that were enraptured to her through the use of her manipulation of the World Stone, that even though the Nephilim themselves were basically miniature gods, not like demigods, these were like full-on deities, walking around, they still could not quite match the power that resided within the World Stone itself. And so Anarius and Lilith fought, and Anarius eventually won. But he still had love for Lilith, and so instead of killing her, used the World Stone to banish her to the Abyss, so that way, she wouldn't be killed, but she would be forever imprisoned. And he, in his divine mercy, allowed the Nephilim to live. They just had to, not bother him and pay him the respect that he was due. And he would use the World Stone in order to go through and dampen their power so they would not be a threat to him. The Nephilim took, they took this as an act of aggression. They weren't happy about this. We're going through and being, I'm going to lessen you. I'm going to take away that which makes you unique in creation. And so they fought back against him. But Anarius had complete mastery over the World Stone. And this entered into an event known as the Scouring, in which Anarius wiped out the vast majority of the Nephilim on the planet. And those few that survived went into hiding. They were fearful of him. But he didn't go looking for them just so long as they were, afraid or subservient to him. He would allow them to exist. And through manipulation of the World Stone, he created a dampening effect that with every successful generation of Nephilim, their powers were further inhibited. So that way you got to the point where you had beings that were just humans. They weren't Nephilim anymore. That is kind of like where we come to in the grand geological scale of things in Sanctuary. We now come to that time where humans are humans. They're not Nephilim. They have that potential, that potentiality within inside themselves to awaken that spark and grasp onto that power to varying degrees. And that's why you have, some that awaken that Nephilim spark, like Aiden did in Diablo 1, that allowed a simple warrior in the armies of Condurus to strike down, one of the three prime evils, the Lord of Terror, as well as, the abilities that were enhancing, the collection of heroes from Diablo 2, that together were able to combine their forces and take down not just a reborn, even stronger Diablo, but a reborn Baal and Mephisto, and take their onslaught straight into the heart of Hell itself. Until you had Diablo 3, where you had the Nephilim, that more or less awakened the almost like the full potential of their power, were able to strike down the combined forces of all of the evils, reformed as the Prime Evil, as kind of an avatar of Tathamet, but were also able to strike down Mathiel, who at one time was, you know, the leader of the Angiris Council and considered one of the most powerful archangels, making him one of the most powerful beings in existence, that would, you know, easily be able to rival the power of Diablo, Mephisto, or Baal on a good day, but who was then infused and glutted himself with the power of millions of souls of humans, and all of those little tiny sparks of Nephilim power that existed within them, in the Nephilim of Diablo 3 was able to strike him down as well. And so it's one of those things that you have like this huge, huge, you know, power boost. And these are things that are, you know, were able to be like for thousands of years, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands. We don't know the full scope of time on Sanctuary, that, you know, the World Stone act as an inhibitor to stop beings of that power. You know, the World Stone was able to just be like, no. You are not allowed to be a god. And, you know, that kind of like speaks to just how powerful the World Stone itself was, that it existed for so long and had that ability to just, you know, allow a regular angel. You know, Anarius was an archangel, so it put him a step above others, but he wasn't a member of the Angiris Council. He wasn't one of the aspects, you know, like Tyriel was the aspect of justice or the aspect of wisdom that was Mouthiel and such. Yeah, he was just an angel. But because he had the power of the World Stone, he was able to take on an army of Nephilim. You know, he was able to go through and, you know, strike down and hold at bay the armies of heaven and hell, you know, during the Sin War, once they found out of the Sanctuary's existence. He was able to go toe-to-toe for a limited amount of time against a fully powered Nephilim because of his mastery of the World Stone, and was only defeated because that Nephilim, Uldisian, basically ripped the World Stone's power away from Anarius. And only through going through and manipulating the World Stone was Odysseus able to actually take him on. And, you know, that's kind of like it. Like, what full potential does the World Stone have? We don't know. And we might not ever know, because, of course, at the end of Diablo 2, the World Stone was destroyed by Tyriel. But, like I said, its story still isn't over, because we have Diablo Immortal, which takes place 5 years after Diablo 2, and the big kind of lore hook, the story draw in for Immortal, is the hunt for the pieces of the World Stone. And what we got to see in the technical alpha, you know, which is up to level 45, so a good section of the way through the game and the story, but not the complete picture, was we're able to find like some shards of the World Stone that various agents throughout Sanctuary had been using for their own nefarious deeds. You know, we know that Skarn, one of Diablo's lieutenants, is looking for shards of the World Stone in order to try and hasten the resurrection of his lord Diablo. While at the same time, the Countess, you know, was using these shards of the World Stone in order to empower herself and bring about her own resurrection and empowering her followers. Those poor Sisters of the Sightless Eye just do not have very good luck in life, do they? Whether they're corrupted by Diablo, corrupted by Andariel, corrupted by the Countess, they've got a bad lot in life. I can't wait to see what happens with them in Diablo 4, since the Sisters of the Sightless Eye are going to hopefully be making some sort of a cameo appearance, at least in Diablo 4 with the introduction of the Rogue class. But, you know, we've got all these people that are going through and finding these pieces of shards, these pieces of a god around Sanctuary that were corrupted by Baal. You know, Baal's evil, his soul, merged with the World Stone at the end of Diablo 2 that necessitated Tyriel in order to destroy it, because we wouldn't know what would happen if a fully corrupted World Stone was under control of the forces of Hell. What could they do? Anarius, who just had control of the World Stone, could stop Nephilim and could stop the combined forces of Heaven and Hell. What happened if your actual being, your full soul, had merged with that power and become something more of it? don't know. That's a scary thought. But, you know, that demonic taint is, you know, very far-reaching. And so these shattered pieces of the World Stone that reigned over Sanctuary after the end of Diablo 2 brought corruption with them. And we know from just, like, some of the panels and the story hooks for Immortal that a lot of the story is going to revolve going and hunting down various shards, you know, of the World Stone that have been corrupted by Bale and are, you know, bringing evil entities into existence in addition to just drawing the attention of other, you know, evil and malignant beings that are out there that can that see the potential of the power that these artifacts contain in order to further their own goals. And so a lot of Immortal is going to be going and, you know, correcting these issues, finding these shards and such. And I wonder, you know, we've got like 15 years to play with between Immortal and Diablo 3. And I would even wager to say that they probably didn't find all of the shards and that there would still be some pieces that would be left of the World Stone after. The Diablo 3 story, the original story, you know, focused on the Black Soul Stone. But eventually kind of came around a little bit to the World Stone, because the place where we fought Malthiel at the end of Reaper of Souls was the holding place for the World Stone. And Malthiel, in his books, The Path of Wisdom, noted that the souls of the dead humans, the dead Nephilim, seem to be drawn to that place naturally. And that no one quite knows what happens to human souls once they kind of like pass beyond. Even the necromancers that are able to call souls and such mention that there is something that when a soul like kind of like finally goes to rest, they're no longer, they kind of like, they're able to go beyond the reach of even their power. And they're not sure what happens to them at that point. Where do they go? What happens to them? But Malthiel kind of followed that trail, and they're still being summoned to where the World Stone once was, even after its destruction. And that's a little bit of a head scratcher, you know, and definitely leads into things to come, which, you know, as I've mentioned on the show previously, we might have a little bit of an idea, because there was some story thread that they originally wanted to do with Diablo 3 that involved the World Stone. Chris Metzen at a couple of BlizzCons went into detail about what the World Stone was, the impact that it had, you know, throughout all of creation and you know, the Diablo franchise's history. And I still will always remember this one question that he posed to the audience is, you know, is the World Stone truly destroyed, you know, or is it just its physical presence? What more could exist, like, in a metaphysical nature of the World Stone besides just its physical, nature? And that's, like, one of those ones where it's, like, you're leaving things open for, like, a return of the World Stone, or it's not fully destroyed, or there's some aspect or, you know, part of its being that's out there, which, you know, makes sense. This was a piece of God, more or less, that kind of just came to rest in the center of creation. And, you know, it, sure, I could buy it. There's going to be some fragment of it that's left out there, you know, something out of phase, something that we don't understand, that you can't touch, you can't feel, but it's still there. And I get the feeling that this is something that we're going to see in Diablo 4. Even though they haven't talked about the World Stone or anything like that, with the inclusion of Lilith in Diablo 4 and her being the big bad evil guy, the poster child for the title, it has to tie into. There is no story of Lilith or Anarius that does not somehow work with the World Stone. Those three are intertwined at like their core concept levels. And to involve Lilith in any shape or form, it is going to eventually lead back to something with the World Stone. And so I am really, really looking forward to what we might learn. You know, there is some possibility that we might get some further hints once we get the chance to go through and play Diablo Immortal and hunt for some of those World Stone shards. Because the story that we got in the technical alpha wasn't complete. We found a World Stone shard, and we were able to go and, you know, take it from the newly resurrected Countess. We take it back to Deckard Cain, where he goes through to try to cleanse it, but he's unable to, in that we have to try and be rid of it. But there's no way that we can destroy it through mortal means. And it was only going and learning, you know, kind of like at the end, we find, you know, that we have to go into like Zoltan Kul's archives to find more of his research and knowledge of it. We find that angelic weapons are capable of going through and harming the structure of the World Stone, and, you know, Tyriel being able to destroy it. And that we have to go and try and find, you know, something of angelic nature. And that's where the story kind of caps off, of us going into this ancient Nephilim prison to try and find an angelic artifact that we might be able to use to destroy or damage or alter this Worldstone fragment in some form. And then that's where the story ends. I'm not sure if we'll ever get more of that story, you know, because they can always go through and just, well, that's where the story ends, level 45, and this next technical alpha, you can grind to 60, but we're not showing any more story. But, you know, they did say, you know, from the last quarterly conference call, the target date for Immortal is 2021. Now, they haven't officially put that out in marketing or advertising, but, you know, if they're mentioning that in their investors' earning calls, I think that that is, you know, a pretty firm internal release date. And why I keep talking about, you know, Immortal on the show, because I expect at some point we'll get some updates or something soon. Because, hey, we're, you know, it's almost April. We're coming up on a third of the way through the year. We gotta move. We got some stuff to go through and kick into gear here. Come on now. But yeah, that's just, you know, some of the, like, the little of my thoughts have been going through, running around with the like the history of the World Stone and where those things could lead us. What else is out there to go through and talk about? You know, with regards to it. What more can we learn of the World Stone or its powers? You know, is this something that is still worth fighting for? Because, you know, the Eternal Conflict has kind of been on pause since the Sin War. It was a little bit with the events of Diablo 3, with the Hell's invasion of the High Heavens, you know, reinstigated that a little bit. But as we've seen in the Diablo 4 lore panels, Heaven has shut itself off. They're closed for business. So kind of like the Eternal Conflict is at a standstill for, you know, whatever the time frame between Diablo 3 and Diablo 4 is. You know, what is there for them to fight over now, besides just to wipe out one another? It used to be about, sure, they hated each other by their very nature, but they still had a purpose, that it was to find and control the World Stone, even though neither side could really use it to its full potential. But now, after the creation of Sanctuary, and they know what the World Stone is capable of doing, maybe there's something more that they could do with it, some other new way that they had never thought of before to manipulate its power or use it, if they were able to find, you know, a piece of it or its essence or its soul. But yeah, what is going to be the new basis of the Eternal Conflict and the events of Diablo 4 and going forward? I can't wait. That's one of the problems of going through and being so invested in the story, is you have to wait until the game itself releases, because they never talk about, we will have, you know, almost every single little facet of the itemization and in-game progression and PvP and, you know, skills and slots and all those other types of things before the game comes out. But we're not really going to know a lot about the story. And that's the thing that is like, I gotta wait. I have to wait until the game itself comes out in order to go through and get it. And then this is going to be a living game, so there's going to be more story and more story, you know, as time goes on and such. They mentioned during BlizzCon that some of the rapid fire questions, that we weren't going to see Anarius in Diablo 4. I'm not sure if I believe them. How can you tell a story about Lilith without involving Anarius? Like I said, those two are intertwined alongside the World Stone. I have to say he's gonna have to have some appearance. I mean, he's in the announcement trailer, right? That chained angel, that has to be Anarius. He's in there. He's in the game. He's gotta be. We'll see. But before I close out the show, something that I had mentioned a while ago is that, you know, I do take emails and feedback and such, and there was a couple of questions that Longshot had posted that I had forgot to go through and answer in the last episode, so let me make amends to that one. I'm sorry, Longshot. And so he had asked a couple of questions. These are, like, some questions in regards to BlizzCon and such. Listening to the BlizzCon stuff for PvP and Diablo 4, we know that Blizz leans towards the multiplayer side over solo, but Longshot is a major solo, self-found person. Do maybe 90% solo and 10% multiplayer with a select few friends. He does the game for fun and not for leaderboards. So those PvP areas, is that going to be the only way to gain shards from PvP? And will non-PvP players suffer, or will shards be earned elsewhere? Any ideas? Will these world events bosses be only groupable, or can you soloist do it? And so to, you know, break down some of those questions, from what they have said, because obviously we only just got this information, you know, back in February, that the hatred PvP areas, yeah, it's going to be the only way that you can acquire these shards of hatred. Because the story of the PvP areas is that these are places that are infected with Mephisto's essence and cause anyone within it to become, you know, to be driven towards acts of hatred, as to kind of explain why you're attacking other players and such. And will non-PvPers suffer, or will the shards be earned elsewhere? Well, one of the big things that they were going through and talking about, both, you know, during the panel as well as with, like, the follow-up Q&As and direct interviews and such, is that the shards and the rewards from PvP won't seem to have any real power tied to them. You know, the monsters will still drop loot and stuff like that in those areas, but the shards themselves will be strictly, like, cosmetic in nature. So if it's not, you know, a transmog set that you think is cool, or like a banner or wings or something like that that you want, then, well, guess what? Good news, don't care. If it is, however, a transmog set or some other cosmetic nature that you do want, it sounds like, yes, you're going to be forced to PvP. Though, if you can work it out, you can gain shards by killing monsters in the PvP zone. You don't have to actually engage in PvP while you're there. There will be PvE elements in those zones that you can still acquire the currency from. But when you go to purify those shards to actually, you know, like, solidify them as currency for these cosmetic rewards, you will be alerting everybody else in that zone that you're doing it, and you're going to be the target, you know, for people to come through and bash your skull in. So, there is unfortunately going to be some forced multiplayer aspect for that. But if you're only worried about player power, then no. You're not going to gain any power from these PvP shards or these PvP zones from what they've said or what they've told us. And for the world events and bosses, are they only group, or can a soloist do it? They will be soloable. At least, you know, from what we saw in the demo back in 2019, they were soloable. It took a while, but you could do it. If you were the only person there engaging the boss. So it's going to take some time. It's going to take some good gear and some skill in order to go through and get it done. But the negative aspect of that is, from the comments that they made during you know, some of those developer interviews, there will be no solo self-found mode. And so you're going to be out there in the open world completing these events and fighting those bosses. And even though you might be trying to do it solo, any person can just walk on up and engage in the fight alongside you. You have no way of keeping that experience purely solo. You have no way of making it that way. So, you know, the concept of solo self-found is becoming even muddier in regards to Diablo 4. And the devs continue to not want to support the mode from their comments. You know, they haven't completely ruled it out. It's something that is not on the development radar at the moment, despite a lot of people asking for it. You know, I guess, what was it? The comments that Joe Shelley made were, you know, that some of the fun that he has when going through and like playing solo in Diablo 3 is kind of like self-set guidelines which to play, and like the kind of like a social contract that he makes with himself in order to follow those guidelines. And while that's what solo self-found is in D3, that isn't what people want. They want to be set apart. They don't want to have, to worry about those things or those aspects of having to have the forced multiplayer. But it is like, what is in-game systems going to look like in Diablo 3? Is the game going to be designed around group play even more so than what Diablo 3 is? Now, in Diablo 3, the game is more or less exactly the same between solo and group. You just have power multipliers in groups that allow you to push to higher, greater rifts and such. With the kind of like this open world development cycle for Diablo 4, are they going to take it a step further and create content specifically for groups? Because like greater rifts aren't designed specifically for groups, you just get a greater benefit running them in a group. But like in Diablo Immortal, which is specifically touted as an MMO, Diablo 4 is not. Diablo 4 is strictly just an open world ARPG, whereas Diablo Immortal is being billed as an MMO ARPG. Immortal will have mass group PvP. Immortal will have raids, group dungeons, things of that nature, which they haven't really elaborated on what any of those terms mean for Diablo Immortal, but we have no idea what in-game progression might look like in Diablo 4. Keyed dungeons look a hell of a lot like Mythic Pluses from World of Warcraft, which are, of course, group dungeons. Is this something that's designed to be played solo? Or are the higher keyed dungeons going to be balanced around having a full group? We don't know. And it might be some time before we know. As I was saying leading up to this BlizzCon line, one of the things that we can probably tell as far as the timeline of production for Diablo 4 is how many classes that they announced. Well, they only announced one. There's one that's still a mystery. And I can pretty much guarantee you they're not going to announce what that class is until the next BlizzCon event, whether that's a physical one in November, or they do another BlizzCon line in November or early 2022. We're in that window of when they might make those announcements. We're not sure. Hopefully we'll get that in April and not have to wait till May to learn what their plans are for that. I think Blizzard might still weigh on the side of safety and push things to next year, since without getting too much into world events and stuff like that, vaccination rates and things might only begin to get to safety levels around November. It might be just a little bit too early to begin to plan things, because you have no idea, whether they'll allow mass gatherings in California by November. Will you be able to put 40,000 people into one convention center? Or are there still going to be social distancing limitations, capacity limitations, and things of that nature? And these are decisions that Blizzard has to make now, for the future. And if you don't want to take a loss on an event that they do say that they operate BlizzCon at a loss, but it's not really a loss. It's, they might lose money going into it. It's a giant marketing piece. So it's like saying that the ad campaign that you ran, you operate at a loss. It's a cost that you pay in order to ramp up hype for your product. BlizzCon is a giant marketing piece, so it can safely operate at a loss because it is what it is. It's a marketing cost. More so than anything, it's a subsidized marketing cost at that. But still, it might be one of those ones where they err on the side of caution, just push things to another online event, and it might not be a physical BlizzCon until 2022. That makes me sad. It makes me so sad. But we'll worry about things like that for another time. And so again, thank you, Longshot, for some of those questions. And if you have any questions, comments, feedback or anything like that, please feel free to drop me a line here at the show. WestmarchWorkshop@blizzpro.com. And again, that email address is WestmarchWorkshop@blizzpro.com. You can also follow the show over at the WM Workshop on Twitter, or you can follow me personally, Nineball Gamer, on Twitter. And of course, you can find the episodes here live on Twitch, twitch.tv/blizzpro, every other Wednesday at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Or you can always check the episodes online at YouTube. You know, we're on Spotify, Stitcher, iTunes, you know, your podcasting platform of choice. Eldorian has the show everywhere, anywhere that you can go through and find it. So, you know, feel free, go through, check it out. You know, and again, if you have any questions, anything like that, you know, just drop me a line, let me know. I love going through, listening to feedback, you know, anything that I can do to improve the show. And long shot promise, catch me streaming live for the seasoner opener on April 2nd over at twitch.tv/nineball. And with that, wish you all a good night, and I'll catch you all next time.